Hi, my name is Salome Vögelin. You should now be seeing an image of me on the screen so you get some idea what I look like. I would like to thank Ish for inviting me to this year's Sound Reason Conference and Festival. It is a great shame that I cannot be with you today, but I hope you will find my meanderings around listening and writing interesting, maybe enjoy it a bit like a radio broadcast, and I hope that it will entice some of you to take part and write a daily sound words yourself. I'm a Swiss artist and writer who's been living in London for a very long time now, about 19 years, and I'm engaged in the philosophy and the sensibility of the sonic and of sound. I'm interested in composing sound, in doing sound works. I'm interested in the everyday acoustic environment, and I'm also interested in writing about sound and how we can write about sound, how we can talk about sound, given that at least in Indo-European languages and in the Western philosophical tradition, sound is always an attribute. It is sublimated to the visual in terms of the grammar, as well as in terms of kind of our sensibility towards the world. And this is one of the issues I'm most keen to address in this talk, as well as in general in my work. The title of this talk, and I'd like the next slide, please, is Sound Words, Listening to Unicorns and Airplanes. And I'd like to start with playing a piece of sound work, or an excerpt of a piece of sound work I've composed in collaboration with artist and writer David Mullin. It's called Barry Echo. It is a rather long piece, but I will only play a 3-minute excerpt. The reason I'm playing this on this occasion, because I think it is a good idea to start, when talking about sound, start with listening to sound rather than just talking about sound. But also the piece Barry Echo consists of 104 stories from the current editions of the Welsh newspapers, the Barry Glen and the South Wales Echo. They're read in a Tesco cafe at Culverhouse Cross, which is a place in the south of Wales. Wales, for those of you who don't know, it is a sort of country that's part of the United Kingdom, but sort of to the west, and very insistent on its independence. And so it speaks English, but there's also its own language, Welsh, spoken there. And the artist David Mullin is speaking to his mother, who is registered blind, narrating to her, telling her, reading to her from those newspapers, and she in turn is correcting his Welsh pronunciations. Could I have the next slide, please? So while we'll be looking at that slide, which is an excerpt, a little snippet of the dialogue that's going on, let's listen to the work.
Events are now being held almost daily at Rabina. Is that Rabina?
Rubina
Festival Day, which includes a costume competition, a tug-of-war and live entertainment on Penedre, Rubina.
Rubina.
Rubina. What was that? Penedre.
Penedre. Diary, yeah. Penedre,
Ravenna.
Nummer 54.
From 10:30 a.m. on Saturday, July 7th. To close the festival, a service will be held at All Saints Church, Hjulafellin.
Hjulafellin.
Ravenna.
Rubina.
Rubina. At 6 p.m. on Sunday, July the 8th.
Nummer 55.
That's part of this.
Nummer 56.
Police release photos of 6 Asbo youths. South Wales Police have released photographs of six Barry ewes who have been given antisocial behaviour orders, ASBOs. As reported in last week's GM, the six received the orders, which will last for 2 years earlier this month at Cardiff Crown Court. The six cannot associate with each other for that 2 year period unless under the supervision of the youth offending team. PC John Jones of the Vale Antisocial Behaviour Unit said, all six received numerous warnings, letters and interventions in order to control their behaviour. None of them took the warning seriously enough to address their behaviour and now facing the consequences of their actions, with all receiving antisocial behaviour orders.
Number 57.
This type of behaviour will not be tolerated in the Vale and we will tackle it by using all resources at our disposal. If anyone is aware of anyone breaching their antisocial behaviour order, please contact Vale Police on 02920 222 111.
This piece, The Barry Echo, was originally produced for the Bregenz Kunstverein in Austria in 2007 and was played continually through the tannoy system of the Pfänder gondola in the alpine town of Bregenz as it made its passage up and down the mountain. The piece is loosely based on the book by the Austrian author Thomas Bernhard entitled The Voice Imitator, Der Stimmenimitator. In this book, the author writes 104 parable-style stories based on newspaper reports and hearsay. Our piece, The Barry Echo, both plays tribute to this work, but at the same time drains the original idea of any particular weight to its contingent context of hearing. This piece brings with it the issue of language, of writing and the voice, and how that gets problematized in sound. It brings with it the problem of language as communication, as translation. Is she the mother translating words? Do we get a better understanding of them? Or do we get an understanding of the relationship between mother and son? What does the translation, the writing, serve? Or what does the recording of the conversation that involves interpretation, that involves reading, serve? For me, it is about its own invisibility and all that we make of it. All that we conjure up and how we get dragged into this conjuring process as complicit listeners with a mother, a language, and words we might not always understand. What I'm interested in is that stuff between sound and words, between listening and articulation, and where the two meet, and where they meet in the social sphere, where they meet in communication, where they produce understanding or misunderstanding, isolation and solipsism, and a tentative attempt at approaching each other through speech. To present this relationship between sound and words, I will talk about language, about names and naming things, and finally turn to a language that comes from listening and that can deal with the materiality of sound. Could I have the next slide, please? Unicorns. So it is said that though we have all found out that there are no unicorns, of course there might have been unicorns. Under certain circumstances, there would have been unicorns. And this is an example of something I think is not the case. I think that even if archaeologists or geologists were to discover tomorrow some fossils conclusively showing the existence of animals in the past, satisfying everything we know about unicorns from the myth of the unicorn, that would not show that there were unicorns. This is an excerpt from Sal Kripke's book Naming and Necessity. Following on from this passage, Kripke argues that this thing found by the archaeologists and geologists, despite matching all the traits of the thing we call unicorn, is not a unicorn, because that name unicorn has already been given to something else, to that mystical beast that we all call a unicorn and that thus exists in that name, referencing particular properties, however imaginary. The unicorn we speak of is a real beast because it has a name. It does not have to be validated in flesh and bones, and were such bones to be found, they would be something else. They could not retrospectively climb into the name and its reality, which is the knowledge we have of it. I'm starting my talk via Sal Kripke's example of the unicorn because it illustrates the issue with names and objects, and for that matter, subjects. The word for the thing, which makes the thing into an object or a subject that has an actuality, but that also, through that actuality, obstructs other possibilities. The name locates, identifies and places the thing as object and as subject. Naming actualizes the thing. The named object as noun dominates the sentence and guides our thinking about the world from the knowable and certain object and subject to the action, rather than from the action to temporal and ephemeral objects or subjects as things, thinging, uncertainty. The name expresses an ideality, a truth about things in the world, and thus renders the world reliable, steady and knowable, representing one notion of actuality. The next slide, please. Rather than lingering in the noun, in that certainty and in that stability, I'd like to talk about the possibility of sound. The thing, like the cup on my table, is an actual object. It is real in the most primitive sense of the word. I can touch it. It has a function and a form and guarantees and locates my experience. To be thirsty, to drink tea, to which I relate a value and a name, in which is placed the authority of the cup as object. If the cup was broken, or if it were in a museum, removed from its primary function, unable to hold tea, or highlighting its decorative nature instead, that would be another thing altogether. It would be a possible cup, if only it was not broken, or if only it was not an artwork. But it remains actual as a broken piece of crockery or as an exhibit. The broken or exhibited cup is still actual, but differently real, and it is also still an object with its own name and location, not just a thing. Language makes things into objects by corroborating and locating their experience in a sense of actuality, testified by a name. In this way, language is the underpinning of our idea of the real as a notion of actuality, which is crucially not the same as lived reality, but is the construction of reality as a logical and shared state of affairs. Actuality answers the demands of logic and of language to be real in the sense of being truthful, consistent, and not contradictory. Reality involves the contingent experience, and that might well at times lie, be inconsistent, and even contradict itself. And so as the cup sits on my table, intact and filled with tea, the cup is more than a thing. It is a thing with a provenance and a purpose, a past and the future, more than indeed a present. It is a thing with the authority of the object, qualified independent of my present experience by the validity of its name. It is an object whose property does not contradict its purpose or form. It can go back in the cupboard where it remains a cup. In contrast to this linguistic and logical actuality, sound always remains a thing, thinging. The sound exists strictly in the present and is mostly non-functional unless it signals the function of something else. Sound is as much possible as it is actual, temporarily generating an actuality that might well be different, hinting at the existence of other possibilities hidden in the invisibility of its passing. The quality of the cup is a linguistic reality, autonomous of perception. The actuality of sound is a temporary materiality that demands listening and generates itself as the possibility of the heard. To write about listening in a way that takes care of this contingent, temporary ephemerality of sound that holds more possibility than actuality is what I seek to do in my writing in general and what I pursue particularly through my blog, www.soundwords.tumblr.com. Could I please have the next slide? And here you can see the URL. Through this blog, I try to write about the predicative of the sound. I try to catch the ephemeral and temporal thing, thinging, rather than its name. It is a constant struggle against the pull of language to name and describe in favour of engaging with the doing of the sound as a verb. And I am not sure I ever succeed, but keep on trying nevertheless. Could I have the next slide, please? This is an entry from my blog from October the 8th last year. Airplanes landing sound a menacing shape in the dark, periodically bursting forth from nowhere to pierce a thin, whining line that eventually flattens out into a thick form that covers my space, formless but determined. A small murmur becoming large, a great, big dragonfly enveloping my room, expanding its body and imploding its shape to enfold the whole space with the force of its cry until it moves on, lighter now as if unburdened, vanishing into the night. Language has great difficulty in locating sounds and finds it hard to testify to their existence. The name, the sound of airplanes landing, is not the sound's name, it is the landing airplane's attribute. And thus I cannot place the validity of the thing of the sound in it. I cannot make it, the sound, into an object. The word, the term, the sound of the airplane, has the function of making us aware of the airplane overhead. That is, however, not the function of the sound. It's the function of the name of the object, the sound of the airplane. The sound itself has no function, and so my experience of it, once we disregard the signification of its source, is much harder to locate and harder even to articulate in language. I can try onomatopoeic exclamations, but they mimic the sound only producing another, rather than articulating its actuality. So it remains without a name and without a location, eschewing geography and semantics, and thus it must continue as a thing thinging presently, proffering possibilities rather than actualities. The sound of the airplane landing offers me a possible thing that might not be the airplane landing at all, but a narrative, an encounter. Listening, I extend what I hear well beyond the recognition of the object into the imaginary scenario of the sonic thing, of what it can be or what it could be. An American airplane, a British Midland flight, a fighter plane, a plane crashing, a plane taking off, not an airplane at all. And so sound hints at the improbability of one truth and meaning of things, and instead opens the imagination to the possibility of all that could be. In this sense, it is unstable and doubtful. I can never be sure of what I hear. Instead, I invent a contingent reality of the heard that is not an actuality, but a possible reality. Sound is not ideal. It does not strive towards one truth about the actual, but enables the imagination of all that could be real. My writing does not seek a translation, but generates the heard as a possibility of what sounded. It is generative and comes from an inventive listening. Or maybe it is a process of translation, but one that knows it does not find certain correspondence, but only possibility of fleeting meetings between meaning. They are plural, uncertain, invisible and passing, and maybe those moments never even happen. And if they do, they are moments of coincidence, dependent on my desire to be understood and you to understand me. And starts with the idea that most likely we misunderstand each other most of the time, and that there are only fleeting moments of understanding among a plurality of meanings that are passing, ephemeral and temporal. Sound invites us to generate a plurality of things out of its own temporal passing, and in this way it offers us an alternative perspective on objectivity and subjectivity. This other perspective is not based on a fundamental essentialism that separates the sonic material from the visual, or from visuality. Rather, it is an acknowledgement that different materials, sonic and visual, fare differently in terms of their influence on what there is, in the sense of what there is as an accepted and shared actuality. Sound's participation in the notion of actuality is not equal to that of the visual. so to focus just for now on a sonic materiality and engage in a sonic version of events should not be seen as essentialist and separatist, but as a temporary inhabiting of a sonic world that, having strengthened its own articulation, will inevitably remit the visual, which, in truth, it can never really leave, but which on its return it can illuminate with new insights. Sound can invite us into a different world in which we can appreciate objects as things, autonomous of their name, established contingently and temporarily, generating different material dynamics and relationships. With my blog, I try to write this invitation, working with language that eschews naming, that challenges the noun and its certainty and its centrality in our perception, and instead seek to explore the predicate, the doing and the action of what is being done, established not in outcomes but in processes, sonic processes, linguistic processes, material unfolding, refolding, folding, offering not object nor subject, but a glimpse of the audible as an alternative state of affairs. The possible thing of sound proposes a different truth and coherence than the name of its source might have us believe. And thus the language articulating this heard must be ready for a complex plurality of truths and consistencies also. This listening and writing about sound does not have to be limited to the soundscape, but can inform how we listen, write and talk about any sonic work. To try this suggestion, I want to play a recent composition of mine that in some ways at least produces a possible thing of sound. Could I have the next slide, please? Not quite sitting down for 6 minutes. to talk about this work and other sound work, I do not want to name the sonic, but to engage in its processes and materialities. I want a language that is part of the listening practice and that understands that this participation is generative, in that it produces words, the material of language, in response to the material of sound, and invites listening as a material process also. Predicative language that ignores the subject in favour of the verb can embrace the possible world of sound from the action of its possible sonic things and can reflect on the limitations, hierarchies and idealities of the actual world that sits in its own name. Such a writing takes care of the audible as the possible, the what could be, or indeed what there is if we would only listen. It gives us access to what is there if we would look past the object into the complex plurality of its processes and materialities. It introduces the notion of a sonic world of sonic things that grants sound the framework of reference that can take care of rather than override its fluent invisibility and contingency. It allows us to reference the material as action, a thing thinging rather than as object, and in this way enables us to reach the complex plurality of what there is. And in this complex plurality of what there is, our ears can uncover alternative states of affairs. Different values and truths can come to light that impact on the actuality of the actual world. The possible world things of sound propose a different truth and coherence than the name of their source might have us believe. And thus the language articulating this heard must be ready for a complex plurality of truths and consistencies also. Listening, I live the logic of the material that creates the world I hear, however incongruous this materiality, however plural and possible this sound. Language needs to reflect its logic, not limited to that of itself. Could we have the next slide, please? And so, how do we write about the sound of the unicorn? How do we write about the sound of something we know to be actual as a mythical figure but have never heard, that might not have sounded, of which we have a prophylmic sense of the real but no sonic memory to hear it by? The notion of the sound of the unicorn invites discussion of how we listen to and write about the inaudible, understood as the yet inaudible but nevertheless present sound. The inaudible is a possible, impossible thing of sound, not because it does not sound, but because we do not hear it yet. And we do not hear it yet because it does not correspond to an object or subject in the world we consider to be actual or possible. It is not an airplane and not even a unicorn. The inaudible is what the artist works with in his or her doubt of the actual and his or her constant pressure on the audible. Thus the inaudible is not non-sounding, it is not a thing that does not thing, but it is not heard. There is a deliberateness in this stance, culturally and ideologically, a desire not to hear or a disinterest strong enough to block it out, to keep it apart. The sonic materiality is there, but we lack the sensibility, will and wherewithal to hear it. If the sonic possible thing lacks language adequate to express its essence, the sense of its experience, rather than name its source, the sonic impossible thing lacks listeners even, but it nevertheless has an impact and thus is worth considering. It is worth talking about and listening out for. Since this is where the artist works, and this is where, out of inaudible strands of sound, the impossible but nevertheless real emerges, that makes the audible sound. Could I have the next slide, please? Listening to the inaudible. While the sonic possible is an alternative state of affairs, that might not convince everybody, that might not be taken into account, that might be deliberately marginalised or simply ignored, it nevertheless demonstrates a possibility, or possibilities even, in how things might be if only we listened. It will for many remain without influence, otherwise it would be actualized. But there is a momentum of conviction, its coherence and truthfulness, strong enough to consider the if that and come to a sonic then what of possibility. Beyond that then what, of the possible thing of sound, the inaudible meets no such conviction and cannot make itself heard. Actual listening, listening that obeys the rules of the actual world, cannot hear it. The inaudible is not immaterial, but is unheard material, the material that cannot bring notice to itself and only exists in the solitary and contingent imagination of a listener who listens to the possible of sound and guesses that there is more to hear. And it is this more to hear which interests me and which is particularly interesting in relation to writing, because if there is always more to hear, writing ceases to be communication and becomes interpretation, generation, invention. It becomes not a futile endeavour but one caught up on the border of the real and the unreal and all the possibilities in between. So maybe it is not a matter of writing as recording, as translation, but as continuation. A doing again and again, rewriting the words until they have an entirely new meaning, a meaning that remains obscure until it is brought forward out of the material, out of the processes, temporarily shining briefly on the surface of knowledge until it is overshadowed by a plurality of other as yet unknowables. This implies an ethics of participation, a need not to read from a distance but to do, to be actively immersed, a call for a contemporary musica practica, a sonic practice of listening, recording, hearing, writing, listening again, and making sound. Thank you.